Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, a blue ribbon blue. The independent Keren Phelps has gatecrashed a prime ministerial media event as the battle for Malcolm Turnbull's old seat of Wentworth gets real. Why Australia is likely to fall short of global targets to reduce premature deaths from diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And a de-escalation agreement for Idlib. Could it prevent the feared attack, likely to include chemical weapons, as the Assad regime aims to retake the Syrian province?
I hate to be pessimistic, but it's hard not to be. I mean, we've had local ceasefire agreements or other de-escalation zones. Those have just not held. And it's hard to see how this one is going to hold given that history.
Welcome to PM. The end of this week marks a milestone for the new Prime Minister Scott Morrison, or Scotty Morrison, as some chummy FM radio interviewees called him in an interview today. He's been in the top job for a month and he's survived his first fortnight of Parliament in charge of the federal government. There is a notch or two on the policy belt. The $4.5 billion funding deal with Catholic and independent schools is progress of sorts. But the government is a long way from being out of the woods. So we thought we'd take stock this Friday with our political reporter, Melissa Clark, in Canberra. Melissa, you've been watching as this has played out, the stoush with private schools over funding. That's been a problem for the coalition. Does yesterday's announcement clear that barnacle for Scott Morrison?
It's certainly a long way towards doing that. It's a big advantage. The Catholic Education Commission had campaigned on this very issue against the coalition in the by-election, particularly in the seat of Longman. And in having this issue now at least resolved with the Catholic and independent sectors, it can avoid a repeat of that at the next federal election. But there's clearly still a battle with the states and the opposition when it comes to funding of public schools. But that's probably more familiar and more comfortable ground for the coalition to be arguing on at an election time. So it does clear more space for other policy issues. And Scott Morrison has made it clear he wants his major focus in his time as Prime Minister to be on the drought. But otherwise, there's a bit of a policy blank space at the moment. There's obviously no energy policy. There's certainly not a willingness to move on public school funding. I mean, these are the reasons why we saw the next COAG meeting cancelled, because these great negotiating points aren't there to have a discussion on anymore. And that's probably why we can surmise that one of the reasons the government jumped so quickly on this national strawberry crisis that we've had is because it is eager to be seeing to be seen to be taking action somewhere.
And possibly the Royal Commission into Aged Care falls into that last category as well. But it's not just policy that Scott Morrison has to contend with, is it? Because there is also the reality that he's the captain of a very unsteady ship still.
That's right, because some of the problems that Malcolm Turnbull faced as Prime Minister haven't gone away just because Scott Morrison is now the Prime Minister, and in fact some have gotten worse. The process of him taking over the leadership has obviously brought to the fore those claims of bullying and intimidation towards Liberal women, and that issue, although it has quietened down after some intense weeks of focus on that issue, we can expect to hear more from Julie Bishop in the next couple of days about that. She is on the backbench, but she is not going away, so that issue is not one that is going to completely quell for Scott Morrison. And he also has the realities of governing with a one-seat majority. That's difficult for Malcolm Turnbull, but it's going to be difficult for him too. It doesn't help that there are questions being raised about the eligibility of Peter Dutton and a lot of focus and attempts to censure Peter Dutton. If there were to be moves there, that could cause problems. Likewise, if they're to lose the by-election in Wentworth for Malcolm Turnbull's seat, that would mean you would have a coalition that doesn't have a majority in the lower house, and that could be very difficult. Difficult time for Scott Morrison. That has to inform how he acts as Prime Minister.
So, a month into the job, do we have a sense of what sort of leader Scott Morrison will be for the nation? Because he has tried to shape his image a little bit in the last couple of weeks, hasn't he?
Well, we certainly know what sort of Prime Minister Scott Morrison wants to be seen as. He wants to be seen as the next generation. That's why we're seeing ScoMo. He's calling himself ScoMo. He's wearing the baseball hat. He's putting out social media videos about rap music and talking about the Sharks. It's certainly an effort to try and make him personable and younger and differentiate himself. But the public knows him as a political hard man, a political pugilist, the man who stopped the boats, who had such a focus on the controversial immigration policies, it's going to be a real challenge for him to step up into a more statesmanship-like role. That will require a much bigger reshaping of his image and a much greater effort for him to grow into some of those bigger strategic roles that he will need to play as Prime Minister.
And of course, speaking of matters strategic, he's got to take carriage of Australia's wider strategic direction at a really difficult time. And we heard from him a bit on that this morning with Sabra Lane in an interview, and I felt that he was really sort of very much stonewalling, not wanting to talk about something like China PNG, for example.
He was sticking very closely to the scripted lines, and I think that probably reflects the fact that he, in his portfolios, has had a very much a domestic policy focus. Yes, as immigration minister, you deal with other nations, but on a very singular and specific topic area, he is going to need to become more comfortable working in a much broader geopolitical environment. And look, not just for him. He's got a new cabinet team. There is a new treasurer, a new foreign affairs minister, and plenty of others in new portfolios as well. And it takes time to be across the portfolio and comfortable with the details. And look, with an election due by May next year at the latest, they don't have much time to settle into those roles.
Okay, interesting times. Thanks very much, Melissa. Melissa Clark, a reporter in Canberra. Well, still with politics, the Liberal Party got an unexpected boost today in its fight to hang on to the Sydney seat of Wentworth, which of course was formerly held by Malcolm Turnbull. The seat in the city's inner east is considered safe Liberal territory, but the analysts see a threat to the government in the form of the popular former AMA chief and local MD, Keren Phelps, who is running as an independent. Ms Phelps, though, has now declared her preferences should go to the Liberal Party. Though on the hustings today, that didn't stop her from gate-crashing a media event where the Prime Minister was due to speak. Sandra Seagian has been at Wentworth today for this report.
Prime Ministers don't usually get shown up at media conferences. But this morning in Sydney's swanky Double Bay, Scott Morrison was beaten to a bank of cameras and microphones by Keren Phelps, the independent candidate for Wentworth.
We're expecting the Prime Minister, actually.
Oh, you are?
I didn't realise you were popping in.
Dr. Phelps explained her surgery was just down the road, so she took the chance to speak to voters through the media.
I know the people of Wentworth very well. I've been around talking to them and asking them what their concerns are. And I think it's very important that that the new member for Wentworth has local understanding and knows what the people of Wentworth want.
The former AMA president is considered a chance to take Wentworth from the Liberals. And she only added to the government's worries by earlier telling voters that they should preference the Liberals last in the October 20th by-election. But today she announced what must be considered a pleasant surprise.
I'm going to announce today that I intend to preference Liberal ahead of Labor. I am standing as an independent, I am a true independent, and that is what I'm going to do.
The Liberals hold Wentworth by almost 18%, but there are fears of a strong backlash because of the way Malcolm Turnbull was thrown out as Prime Minister. With its fancy apartments and multi-million dollar yachts, Rushcutters Bay isn't exactly middle Australia, but it's in the heart of the Wentworth electorate. People here sound disenchanted.
I have no respect for the majority of the politicians in this country now, especially following Malcolm Turnbull's demise, and I'm finding it terribly hard to care.
I'm annoyed about it because I didn't have a chance to say anything about Malcolm Turnbull's demise. We voted for him. He's our local candidate, and we didn't have a chance to support him.
It was terrible the way it's come about, but that's the situation we find ourselves in.
Even with this sentiment, though, it's still going to be tough for an independent or indeed Labor to win here.
I just think the parties are just fusing in terms of they all have the same selfish attitudes, and it's actually about individuals rather than the good of the community or the good of the country.
As far as I'm concerned, there's not anyone that I would have a lot of faith in.
Dave Sharma is the Liberal candidate in the by-election. Graham Morris is a former chief of staff to John Howard, who is now a political consultant.
It's quite an unusual seat for a by-election. And normally there's a swing against the government anyway. So yes, Dave Sharma has the job against him. But I think most people in Canberra on both sides of politics would acknowledge he's the best candidate by a long way, but he's going to have a tough few weeks.
Former Liberal leader and member for Wentworth, John Hewson, knows the area well.
I think the Wentworth by-election is ripe for a substantial protest vote, probably against both major parties, but certainly against the Liberal Party and the madness that we saw just a few weeks ago. It's a winnable seat for a strong independent in the sense that Turnbull had a very significant personal vote.
After their earlier thwarted media conference, Scott Morrison and Dave Sharma eventually fronted the cameras at a school in Bondi, also in the electorate. The Prime Minister says he wasn't fussed by Dr. Phelps stealing his thunder earlier in the day, but what does worry him is the independent candidate's closeness to Labor.
There is only one candidate that is standing up for Liberal beliefs, and that's Dave Sharma. Anyone else pretending to that claim is not there to help the Liberal Party. And the independent, Karen Phelps, is not running to help or support the Liberal Party. As the Labor Party has said themselves, they believe that her candidacy is only there and will help the Labor Party.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. Sandra Siagian, our reporter. A paucity of government spending on disease prevention is one factor that experts say might help explain a new finding that Australia is set to fall short of global targets to reduce premature deaths. About half the countries in the world are also failing to reach the standards, which are about diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease and diabetes, with a target date of 2030. The findings on the progress towards the targets are published in the medical journal The Lancet today. Nancy Notson reports.
Bob, who lives in Victoria, has lived with type 2 diabetes for 18 years. And the 75-year-old is pretty certain what led to his condition. Too many sugary drinks.
It's had a big impact on my life. I've tried to adhere to the dietary requirements that's indicated to me from my doctor and from Diabetes Victoria. I think they've been really helpful, but even so, it's a constant challenge.
Bob is one of the millions of Australians with a chronic disease.
There is no doubt in my mind that if I'd have been much more careful and had undergone preventive measures, I don't think I would have developed diabetes.
Now a new paper from the medical journal The Lancet shows just how badly the world and Australia are tracking in terms of reducing chronic disease. Globally, cancers, cardiovascular diseases, chronic respiratory diseases and diabetes are the leading causes of death, with disadvantaged communities the worst affected. The United Nations has set a range of targets for countries to meet, with the goal of reducing premature deaths from these diseases by a third. And so far, the results aren't good. If things keep going the way they are, more than half of countries, including Australia, won't meet these targets.
These early deaths are unacceptable.
Robert Beaglehole, an Emeritus Professor of the University of Auckland in New Zealand, is a co-author of the Lancet study.
It's very disappointing. Australia has been a very well-performing country, particularly with regard to reducing death rates from heart disease and stroke. But we are concerned that it's not going to meet the 2030 target, and it may not meet it till 2040.
Professor Robert Beaglehole says given Australia's strong economy and comprehensive public health system, it should be doing much better.
It's a bit hard to tell from this data, and we are looking into reasons for poor performance and high performance more deliberately. But in general, we're reducing death rates from these chronic conditions through better prevention around the major causes and better treatment. So somewhere in there, Australia is falling down.
Prevention, says Rosemary Calder, Director of the Australian Health Policy Collaboration at Victoria University, is a key area where Australia is lagging.
When we look at the spending on health, the vast majority of all our health budget is focused on treatment.
She says what is spent on prevention is nowhere near enough.
The current estimates of what is spent on prevention is that it's less than 1.3% of the total taxpayers' expenditure on health. We need to change that because we now live in a community where chronic disease is the problem, not infectious disease.
Rosemary Calder's organisation has helped produce feasible targets to reduce chronic disease in Australia and provides national advice on how to achieve those. Things like reducing salt, sugar and alcohol while increasing physical activity, especially among children, will help prevent chronic disease. Dr. Calder says there needs to be a huge shift in perspective.
We're still in a culture and a public discourse which focuses on we need more doctors, we need more hospital beds, we need more treatments, because that's what people think they need and politicians worry about what people think they need. We have to do a lot more education of people, generally speaking, to understand that keeping your health is much more important than recovering from ill health.
PM has contacted the Federal Health Department.
Nancy Notson with that report. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. There is a reprieve, for now at least, from a feared catastrophic military onslaught against the 3 million people in Syria's Idlib province. Russia and Turkey came up with a de-escalation agreement this week, though experts are pessimistic that it will work. And if it doesn't, the inevitable all-out attack by the Assad regime is expected to include the use of chemical weapons again. It'd be confirmation that US military retaliation for past chemical attacks has failed as a deterrent and could spur the US to go for higher profile targets right up to Syria's command structure. Dr. Christopher Bolan is Professor of National Security Affairs at the US Army War College. I asked him first what's known about this de-escalation agreement.
We don't know a whole lot, so we really don't know where the extremist forces are going to go, if they're going to go. There have been some interviews with Syrian opposition force commanders who have said until they know the details, they don't know how they're going to react. They don't know what they're going to do. We know from interviews with Russian MOD officials that we think there's maybe a phase two or phase three to this de-escalation agreement or creation of a buffer zone in the Idlib province. We think maybe by the middle of November that all the rebel and extremist groups that are remaining in the Idlib province as a whole are supposed to surrender whatever heavy weapons they have with the aim of restoring Syrian government control to the entire province by the end of the year. And there's absolutely no indication that the Syrian population that remains in Idlib, that's primarily Sunni population, is really, you know, willing to agree to that. So I think, like many things in international affairs, there are actually more questions raised than there are answers.
What do you think then will happen in Idlib in the end? Will there be this devastating last push that's been so feared?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be pessimistic, but it's hard not to be. I mean, other times in Syria's history of the civil war where we've had local ceasefire agreements or other de-escalation zones, those have just not held. And it's hard to see how this one is going to hold given that history. And what I fear is, I mean, President Assad has said, of course, his goal is to recapture all of Syria. And Idlib is one of the primary provinces that stands in his way in doing that. And I'm not sure that Russia, even though they can discourage him from that goal, is actually capable of withholding him from pursuing that goal that he sees, of course, as key to his survivability.
The other element here that you've written about is the question of the role of chemical weapons. Reporting suggests the regime is again preparing to use chemical weapons. What do we know about that?
Well, we certainly know that they've used chemical weapons before. We've seen estimates from various sources, UN and US sources, that chemical weapons have been employed by the Assad regime upwards of 50 times throughout the conflict. And the U.S. has actually opted more recently under President Trump to respond to those attacks. We had a unilateral attack in 2017 in response to a Syrian chemical weapons attack. But there was another one in 2018. And then the U.S., joined by Great Britain and France in a coalition attack, actually launched a combination of missile and air attacks on a series of Syrian chemical weapons facilities. So the U.S. and coalition partners have made good on threats to retaliate for any use of Syria's chemical weapons in the past, and I suspect that will be the case this time around.
The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, I think the quote was, Syria has been warned about not using chemical weapons. Given what you've just said about recent responses under the Trump administration to the use of chemical weapons in Syria, what might Mike Pompeo's threat mean in practicality if chemical weapons are used again?
Well, I mean, that'll be a major debate within the U.S. government. I mean, the key question, of course, will be, I think, not whether there will be a U.S. military response, because I think there will be a U.S. and I suspect a coalition response, too. The question will be kind of the extent. In the past, we've strictly limited those attacks to Syria's chemical weapons facilities. The key question will be, well, we've done that twice now. If that doesn't act as a sufficient deterrent, do we need to expand that target set, potentially to include the Syrian forces themselves? If not, President Bashar al-Assad and the command and control of his armed forces in the region. And that'll be a big debate. I mean, officially, the U.S. position is we're not pursuing a regime change strategy. But President Trump has called the Assad regime a criminal enterprise for employing chemical weapons before. So I can't be certain that the U.S. objective there won't necessarily change under the threatened use of serious chemical weapons.
So is there still a possibility, are you saying, that the United States might fulfill something more substantial around what President Trump has said, as you quote there, about President Assad?
I mean, I do. One, I'm not in the government, but I do think, I mean, that is the trend line, right? I mean, up until very recently, up until September, as a matter of fact, I mean, the U.S. government and officials have been very clear that our objective in Syria was limited to the destruction of the Islamic State and terrorist forces. That battle is coming to a close. I mean, the ISIS caliphate in both Syria and Iraq has really collapsed. But there was an interview with a newly appointed envoy to the Department of State, a retired ambassador who served in both Baghdad and Ankara, Jim Jeffries. And he actually said, look, our objective now is not limited just to the destruction of ISIS, but it also includes the ousting of Iranian forces for the region. So you're starting to see a bit of mission creep in terms of what U.S. objectives are.
Chris Boland, a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Dr. Christopher Boland is Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Army War College. Dementia experts estimate that it's a trillion-dollar disease, but they say that they're between hope and frustration when they consider the state of dementia treatment, research and diagnosis. The global advocacy body Dementia International says that's because there is still no cure for the brain disease that affects millions of people worldwide, although researchers do hope they're getting closer. Sarah Maunder has our story.
When Phil Hazel was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 4 years ago, he didn't know how common the disease was.
Had no idea. No idea whatsoever. So I almost said, you know, we all think we know what dementia is, but it's far from what you think. And I was surprised I was diagnosed. My father was diagnosed, but he was 91. So I drew the short straw, I think, in the family.
The Sydney sider was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when he was just 55.
You've got to go out and tell people, otherwise you won't get help. Being open about it will make your life, you know, a heck of a lot easier.
Dementia Australia says dementia is the second leading cause of death in the country, and it's releasing research about people's perceptions of the brain disease for World Alzheimer's Day. Marie McCabe is the chief executive.
We found that 80% of people had heard of dementia, which is fantastic. More than 60% said they didn't know what to say to somebody with dementia and that they were worried they wouldn't be understood or they might say the wrong thing.
The ABC's Four Corners program this week revealed systematic problems in the way elderly people, particularly those with dementia, are treated in aged care facilities. It included horrific cases of neglect and drugging of dementia patients, and the federal government announced a royal commission into the sector. Marie McCabe is supportive of the move.
And I think it's important to say that there are many providers that provide really good aged care services. And, you know, there are providers that don't. And it's really important that we ensure that our elderly are cared for in the way that they need to be, that their needs are met, and that they're safe.
Chris Lynch, the Deputy Chief Executive of Dementia International, says Australia actually has a good international reputation when it comes to dementia patient care, diagnosis and research.
Like everywhere else, it has to compete for funding and attention with lots of other areas and challenges. But the Australians have a very strong presence on the international stage.
Dementia International's research released today reveals why there's some progress on dementia care and research, much more needs to be done to address what's becoming a major public health issue.
As of 2018, we estimate that dementia is a trillion-dollar disease, and that figure's set to double as well. We need a huge amount more in terms of research funding to make the breakthroughs that we need to tackle this disease.
Dementia International's Chris Lynch, Sarah Maunder with that report. A social media site set up by an Australian social enterprise has become an unlikely ally for sex workers in the United States. Switter was launched in March as likely the world's first social media network specifically for the sex industry as a response to US laws that spurred online sites to close services for the sex industry. Flint Duxfield reports.
When the Fighting Online Sex Trafficking Act was signed into law by Donald Trump in April this year, it was meant to put an end to online sex slavery. But for Californian sex worker Shirley White, the bill has had a devastating effect.
My phone stopped ringing immediately. I struggle every day to find out if I'm going to have a room the next day. And I never had to do that before this.
What impact did that have on you personally?
It messes with your head. It just, you become, you don't know what to do. You don't know where your next meal's coming from. 3 weeks ago, I tried to take my life from it. This is killing us.
Advocates say Shirley White's experience is common throughout the sex industry. Kate Diadamo is a partner with rights group Reframe Health and Justice.
The idea and the intention was about trafficking, but the problem is the language is so broad and so undefined. So that means that websites don't know how to differentiate between people who have been trafficked, people who haven't been trafficked. Operating a website just potentially could put you completely into bankruptcy.
The most significant site to close was called Backpage, which was shut down after its founder pled guilty to money laundering and conspiracy to facilitate prostitution. But the impact didn't stop there.
People who were advertising on those platforms had to move to other locations, including brothel-based work, including street-based work. A lot of the harm reduction tools that people were utilizing to stay safe disappeared as well. There have been reports of violence for people, especially people who said, you know, I used to feel comfortable screening and I've never been assaulted. And now I don't feel comfortable doing the same kind of rigorous screening I was doing before. And I've been assaulted since.
With dedicated websites closing down, many sex workers turn to social media sites like Twitter and Facebook. But those sites have been known to block sex workers in the past. And Kate Diadamo says the industry is being forced into an increasingly precarious position.
Right now, there's so much panic and there's so much fear because everyone is just waiting to get kicked off the next platform or banned from the next advertising site. That is having a huge impact on people's mindsets right now.
And that's where Switter comes in. It's a microblogging site, much like Twitter, but designed to be the first social media site specifically for the sex industry. It's the brainchild of Australian social enterprise Embassy 4, which set the network up in response to the Foster Bill. Eliza Sorensen is one of the group's founders.
When we first started Switter, we wanted to provide people a way to be able to communicate. We were really afraid of the entire community just disappearing off Twitter because the community keeps each other safe. They tell people of bad actors, who to work for, who not to work for. So we expected to get maybe 500, 1,000 users. But within the first week, we'd hit 10,000. And at the moment, we've got over 137,000.
But it hasn't been easy. The group was forced to set up its own distribution network after its original provider, Cloudflare, took them offline for violating their terms and conditions. And now, with users growing daily, a site which initially cost just $12 a month to run is costing up to $2,000 a month in hosting costs alone. But Eliza Sorensen says with concerns that the US authorities may try and shut down the site, their largest costs have been legal fees.
Our lawyers said that we technically are breaking Foster Sesta, but what we are doing is harm reduction and we're not profiting off Switter. So that's kind of how we're getting around it.
Some would say that you are essentially assisting people to break the law in another country. What would you say to that claim?
I would say that not all laws are fair. At the end of the day, there's still a lot of consenting sex workers, more than there are sex trafficked victims, and they deserve to be protected.
For sex workers like Shirley White, Switter has indeed done just that.
Switter's been really useful. I mean, you can put it out there what you need, and the clients are coming back. And the thing with Switter is that no matter where I log in, there's somebody going to be in that area logging in also. So that way your client base is there.
Has business increased since you've gone onto Switter?
Oh, yes, definitely.
What sort of an increase have you seen?
I'm not on the street. I have clients because there's no other way for them to reach us. I mean, it's a support system we didn't really have before.
California escort Shirley White, Flint Duxfield, our reporter. And that's PM for this week. PM supervising producers this week were Nick Grimm and Michael Edwards. Technical production by Scott Johnson and Jane Stacey. Research by Flint Duxfield. The PM team is going to be back with you on Monday evening, but tomorrow morning Thomas Ariti will have Saturday AM. No, Nick Grimm will have that for you, actually. That is PM for this week. Thank you very much to the team and thank you for joining us. I'm Linda Mottram. Hope you'll join us again next week. More great radio ahead tonight, though. Have a great night.